First, we welcome back to the program the author of his latest book. It's called Sam Cooke Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. His Scrooge book coming out soon as well. Writer Colin Fleming joins us. Hello, Colin.
Rich Guy Kimball, the man of the match with the Sea Dog, the man on the march. A couple guys doing some wordplay.
It's magical. How's your head?
My head is better. Thank you for asking. The migraine has relented over the last few days. I don't know what happened. I think I might have had the COVID. I think I've had the COVID a bunch, actually, Rich Guy. I think it's just something that's happened to me. But I was hot, and I didn't feel right. I'm not a big complainer unless I have like the pneumonia. So I just powered through.
A few extra thousand steps will clear out whatever ails you.
That is what I do. Yes, I refuse to give in to sickness. Like, I'm scared of a lot of things, like hot things and sharp things, and certainly the way things have been going for me and all that stuff, but I am not a complainer when it comes to physical things. So I have this guy who is this buddy of mine who's a pretty weak guy, and he'd be like, I said to him, like, we need a converter for, like, Colin to John. We need to get, like, some sort of instrument that can gauge, because he would have been, I know he would have been like, oh, I was in bed all day yesterday. My kids had to bring me tea, and I had a scone. Definitely would be like that. So I say some things to him that I can't say here, but yeah. Weakness, Kimball. Got to stamp it out.
I'm pretty weak. I think most men. You're the exception. No,
that's
you're the...
not the kind of Zulu warrior pushback.
No, I'm not. I mean, some things, yes, but I don't know. I'm like, I think the majority of men, I'm a big baby when I get sick. Now, if I were genuinely sick with something, I would hope I'd be tougher, but little things, I cry, I moan, I wail. Can you please help me? Could you please turn that down? Could you bring me something from my head? Those things. I asked Carrie to rub my bunions today. I don't even have a bunion.
The summer before I knew you, I had the pneumonia, and when I was a kid, I had these migraines that were so bad that they thought maybe I had a brain tumor. So, like, I knew kind of, like, really intense head pain, but I had pneumonia in August of 2016. My temperature went to 106, and I was in agony for, like, 2 weeks, and I gave myself a deadline. I remember it was, like, by my birthday, I said, this will be behind you, and you'll be running stairs again. We're not going to just sit around and die of this, but I had to go to the hospital twice. And I think somebody else would have stayed in that hospital, but I came home each time. It was 106. I thought, oh, dear. Yeah, right. That's like, it felt like fairly record-breaking. I was encouraged when I got to the hospital, and they didn't right away, like, ship me into the back. Like, they still made me wait, which I took as a good thing.
Yeah, and real things, I can be tough. Like, a few years back, I've had kidney stones a number of times, and I felt it coming on. I knew what it was. I went to the office, and I said to the principal, hey, I'm going to be passing a kidney stone soon. And he looked at me like, well, should we call an ambulance? I'm like, no. I'm just going to drive myself to the hospital. I'll be fine. Are you sure somebody can take you? Nah, I'm good. But halfway home,
How did you know?
Because I
how
felt...
How did you know it was coming on?
I felt the pain. I'd had them before I knew exactly what it was. But about halfway home, I had to pull over and just rest for a few moments. I got to the hospital and I said, I'm going to pass a kidney stone. Can you give me one of those little mesh things that I'm gonna pass it into, because it won't take long. And I was in there about 2 minutes. Like, bing, there it is. Thank you. I'm good.
So, as the listeners fire up their stoves and make their dinner out there, and they have this robust imagery.
Yes.
To savor their meals with.
Nice. Yep, absolutely. Have a little stone on the side. All right, much to talk about today, Colin. Let's begin with a fascinating Thanksgiving-themed episode of the classic radio show Suspense, The Screaming Woman. I love this one. I just love the little girl. Dad, there's a screaming woman under the lawn.
Oh, yeah. He's a dick at first, isn't he? Like, he's so condescending.
Oh, just, honey. We'll talk about it later, like, after dinner.
Oh, he's all about, like, I feel like his family could have been, like, lit on fire next to him. He's like, I'm eating some bird. This is getting eaten. This is what's going to happen first. And through a Bradbury story, and the thing about Bradbury is that, like, his actual prose on the page could be pretty purple, but when it's streamlined for radio, it can work really well. And I think this is a pretty believable story about a kid who's not being believed, and they think that she's, well, not necessarily crying wolf, but there's this, conveniently, this like this vacant lot next to her house, which reminds me a little bit about like the pond at the dump in that episode, or not that episode, but that public information film we were talking about recently.
Oh yeah,
it's kind of like this convenient sort of like nasty, mangy lot that you don't play in, the type of lot that like these days you'd find syringes in and like stick yourself, that kind of thing. And when she's there by herself, this little girl, like playing during the Thanksgiving holiday, she hears this screaming from under the ground. And you don't know, like at first, is this girl crazy? What's going on here? Is she having some sort of breakdown? Is her imagination overactive? And she has this little friend. I think the kids are really good in this. She has this little boyfriend, and he comes over, and they're playing or whatever, and he's able eventually to hear this too. But like when the adult is there, you know how it's going to go. There's not going to be like any sound that is made at that time. So she thinks that there's this woman buried alive, and it becomes this mystery that she starts to piece together involving like the guy who owns the lot, and there's like this other guy, like a red herring, tries to chase them off. And as it turns out, yeah, there's someone buried there, buried alive.
Some of Bradbury's best work involves kids. I love, and I think it may have been on Suspense, a radio play called Zero Hour, where kids are planning to help an invasion by aliens. And of course, none of the adults believe it. They think, oh, it's great. Play your alien game. And then it turns out to be the real deal.
The best version of that, I think, is from X-1. It's the most streamlined version of that particular story you mentioned. And you're right. It's a good point. He is excellent with kids. And I always feel like you can tell sort of how well someone writes, the way they handle stories about children, because children possess, it's difficult, they possess a wisdom in some ways that adults won't have, because adults have turned their back on curiosity and on wonder. At the same time, that wisdom is tempered by naivete and their lack of experience, so they can stumble into these profound moments, but they're also children. And they don't have maybe that many profound moments. They're almost accidental, but they count just as much because they're hard won in their way. So in that particular story, you have this rose bush, and this rose bush becomes this portal between the worlds. Mm. And it's like, why not? It makes sense. I mean, it makes as much sense as anything else with another race. So I think the kids in this are excellent. And also, they have these communications via telephone. And that allows for exposition without it being that official, written into dialogue exposition, because the phone conversations are natural within the story. When you call someone up on the phone, or at least this is how it used to be, you had a reason to call them. Like you were telling them a bit of information that, oh, I meant to tell you after you went home today, we were playing in the playground and everyone said you suck ass. Like that type of thing is kind of like an update like that. So the updates work well here, and I also like, even though we get this outcome, we get a result, we get an answer, there's the neat trick that the ending is still open-ended.
Yes.
It's not wrapped up bow style. Like, it happens off stage via that phone conversation.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Up next, a wonderful performance, recitation, whatever you want to call it, from Orson Welles interpreting John Donne. This was fascinating. I'd never heard this before.
I'd mentioned to you a few weeks ago when we were talking about Christopher Lee in his reading of Dracula, that like 3-hour reading of Dracula, that was one of the two best read performances that I've ever heard. And this is the other one. This is my top two. And I don't think many Orson Welles people know this at all. So you have, it was for a program that had exactly one episode where it was supposed to be Orson Welles reading, which is a great idea for a show. And I wish he had done more of that. And someone could say, oh, he did the Mercury Theater. He has all these radio things. It's still not the same as reading something. and he didn't write books, so he couldn't like do his own recordings of those. I always think about that. People say that to me too. They're like, you should, when you have audiobooks, you should be the one doing the reading. I think that would work really well, whether it's like Meatheads or Sam Cooke or Buried on the Beaches, that kind of thing. And Wells's voice was suited for it as well. So this is really his moment as a reader. And he had remarked a number of times over that, for instance, with Shakespeare, and Shakespeare was the great passion of Orson Welles's life for all of his interests. It was Shakespeare he cared about more than anything. He said, to appreciate Shakespeare, you have to read Shakespeare aloud. And so I think he's bringing some of that notion to bear on John Donne. And John Donne was someone who was, in this particular work, No Man Being an Island, he's in a Thoreau type of vein, where the voice is very Thoreau-like, wouldn't you say, where he says, he basically says, okay, this person sucks, that person sucks, that person sucks, but it doesn't matter. The death of each man, each human, people prefer, diminishes me. Mm. It takes from the human store. And I think that's something that's not strictly true literally, or even really that close to true literally, but in terms of the idea, ideologically, I know exactly what he's saying. He's talking about sort of the connection we have with each other and the right that we're supposed to do by each other and the empathy we're supposed to have for our fellow human.
And what I like about it is that Wells, who is so distinctive in everything he does, is very subtle in this. It's very underplayed.
Wells, he's one of those people, like the collective of the Grateful Dead, I think people just get a lot of things wrong with Wells. I think there are all of these tropes and saws in place that don't get challenged very often, because as you say that, I agree with you, but it flashes through my mind so many other things he's done where he's not this larger-than-life presence. He's this larger-than-life presence maybe because he's so effective, but not because he's oratorically draconian, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Thinking about something like his performances in The Hitchhiker. Now, that's a bravura set piece for one person. He's just going to handle the entire thing. Like, the whole going my way guy doesn't really have a lot to say in that. It's just like Orson Welles, and then he makes that phone call at the end, and his mother's had a nervous breakdown. So it's just him. You could very easily be histrionic doing a performance like that. But he's composed the entire time. I really feel like he finds what suits a given work best, and that's what mm-hmm. he goes with. Think about like The Third Man. He's quite restrained in that right. too. So he's not all over the map vocally here with this reading of John Donne. I think of like Paul McCartney. He shows all of his range, and why don't we do it in the road? That's not what Orson Welles is doing here. And it's this metaphysical work of genius that I think is, I don't want to say it becomes better when it's read aloud by Welles, but it becomes certainly a different creation.
Up next, a fascinating interview from 1937 with Welsh writer Arthur Machen from the BBC, where he makes a statement, and I was all ready to take issue with it, and then I followed his instruction and then began thinking about memorable characters from fiction. And his point is that mm-hmm. supreme artists have no interest in lifelike characters.
Yes, and that's precisely what I wanted to dial in on, and which we should focus on. And he makes the example of Dickens and Chesterton, and he says that Chesterton is nowhere near the writer Dickens is. Chesterton gives us characters that you could go out and meet at the bar, whereas you could never go out and meet the characters that Dickens has in his novels. And I think this made me think of my own work, because people will say to me that these people are out in the world, and this is the alchemy of great art, where you would not have someone in the world at all. Like, take, for instance, Fitty in the story of the same name. You'd never come across someone like that out in the world, but that's the trick. You think you would. That's what he's talking about. Right. He's just not parsing it quite that way, because if you just were relying on the people you know and you've met and your memories and the people you work with and your family and your friends, I don't really know how to put this other than say they're very boring and they live prosaic lives. You can't just transcribe their lives. They're out there, certainly. You know them. You just saw them at work today at the meeting, and you just like called the relative at night and congratulated the friend on the birth of their latest kid. But it's humdrum. So you have to have that alchemy where you have these people that could be out there that are more real than humans in a sense. So what he's also meaning, I think, is that inside of these people is this concatenation of all of these different strands of what a person can be and what a person is and what that character is, that they're emblematic of all these other different people. And that's not just to say that like there's some collage, because they're autonomous, but you wouldn't meet someone like that out in life. But you have to have the reader think that not only would you meet them in life, that's the next person you're going to meet,
right,
and that's representative not just of all of us, but of that reader very specifically, more so than anyone else. That's what the reader has to think. That's what he's talking about. That's what he means when he says someone like Scrooge. Now, Scrooge isn't someone that you know someone like, in that they're a carbon copy of Scrooge, but you also do know Scrooge. It's just in a different sort of manner. So I think that's a huge distinction. If you're, that's what happens with these MFA programs. People are just making a character out of some boob in the class with them from Darien, Connecticut, who also is terrible at writing. But that's what they're doing. They're just transcribing that person and changing the name. That's why those stories, they have no life. They have no point. No one wants them. No one reads anymore. It's because of that saturating the publishing culture. So he's completely right. And the thing that's interesting, too, about Mackin, his best writing, for everything he was saying, his best writing was ghost stories. He was a master ghost. He's one of the three, four, five best ghost story writers we have.
Those characters have to be recognizably human to us. We have to see elements that we understand. But to paraphrase what he says and to relate it to, well, let's say Fitty, you want the reader to come away saying, I've never met anybody like that before. And his response would be, but wouldn't it be great when you did?
But you also want them to think that Fitty is down the block.
Right.
You just haven't met her yet. But when you look across the street and the light goes on in the bedroom upstairs of the house, that could be her putting the light on. That's what you need to think. And it's like, you take like Chad from Meatheads. A number of people said to me, I know someone exactly like that. And that's what people will think. There's this transmutation that occurs, that the human imagination and the need to liken will do some of the work for you. And the true prose artist knows that, but there isn't actually someone out there that like, oh yes, this is clearly like the model for Chad. But it doesn't mean at the same time that that character, that they're this archetype, because they're not. They have to be more, I remember saying this to you one time, they have to be more real than you are and than I am. And that's why I know, for instance, when I make these characters, or when they come to me and they tell me their stories, that's how I know that there's something beyond me. Because that's not just coming from within me, that's coming out of me, but it comes from somewhere else first. And so I think Mackin was well aware of this. It's a fascinating interview. I don't know anyone who knows that this exists. It's from 1937. He has 10 years left in his life, and it's like, what, less than 4 minutes long? And it's such a crucial point. You could save someone the money of going to graduate school for an MFA degree. Play them those 4 minutes. If they really understand it, there's no excuse not to if you just listen to this, then that's so much of the key right there.
Absolutely. Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Let's talk music here. We await the release. Maybe you're going to see it. You're getting an advanced copy, I think, of the Peter Jackson documentary on the Beatles, Get Back. But a tasty little tidbit from rehearsal for the White Album of Cry Baby Cry. And I love the vocal on this.
This is the rocked up version. So I was thinking kind of like the song in general. There are all these different permutations of it. You have the Easter demo, and you have the track that's on the White Album itself. You have this rehearsal that you just mentioned with the heavy, sort of heavy-handed drum performance that they haven't, it's a rehearsal. They haven't figured it out yet. But it strikes me because it's such a McCartney-esque melody. It's something you'd expect McCartney to tumble out of bed and be able to write effortlessly, like sing-along junk, that type of thing. But it's Lennon writing in a McCartney mode and applying this kind of royalty theme to it, the Queen of Marigolds. It's very fanciful. It's like a mashup of the monarchy and Lewis Carroll. Lewis Carroll is somebody that Lennon liked. And it's the Beatles song that I would say I have in my head, running through my head more commonly than any other song. It's in a minor key, but it's certainly not a dirge-like song or anything like that. And it's very... Shane McGowan talked about you need the lilt, and it made sense for Shane McGowan because there's just a kind of a natural lilt to Irish music, and Lennon had some Irish blood in him. And this song certainly is an English lilter. We can almost think of the Queen of Marigold. Like, it's very circular, the rhythm. And that's not something that Lennon would normally do. He was more kind of a linear melodist, whereas McCartney would move in these circular motivic patterns. So to see that little departure, and it's just one of those tracks in the White Album, too, where it's this ostensible throwaway, but it's really not a throwaway at all. It's part of one of the songs that makes that. There was a Russian literary critic, and he talked about the Carnivalesque in like the 1920s and how you would have these labyrinths within novels, and very much the White Album itself. It's not a novel, of course, but as a double album, it's a Carnivalesque album. And it's Carnivalesque in part because you have these like little sideshows. Like, come down this alley. It'll be cool. Look at this little thing going on over here with the puppets. And that's Cry Baby Cry.
And I like the fact that so many of the Lennon vocals are double tracked, and this one is just, it's pure. And it's really, to me, the essence of Lennon.
Yes, Lennon did, it's just one of those funny things where he didn't like his voice. So whenever he could get treatment to it, if you will, whether it's automatic double tracking or just sort of like distortion, anything, echo. He was singing off mic. He sings off mic in Your Blues. You would think that a guy like this, I mean, the best rock and roll singer, I believe, would just embrace kind of those moments of being out there in the vocal nude, so to speak, like he is after the middle eight on This Boy, where he just hangs in the air. On that one note. And so, yes, this is, again, I just, the idea of them rehearsing, and that's certainly what you're going to get, killing time rehearsing with the whole Get Back thing, which I am doing this big piece for the Daily Beast on that. But this is just one of those Beatles songs, too, that no one talks about. It's this hidden away gem that I like them in their so-called like down moments when it's not like, here's the official boom, Hey Jude, because I think something like this is in some ways more revealing of what their sort of soul was.
I agree. Love this version from the BBC back in 94, some early Green Day. And speaking of great vocals, I don't know that Billy Joe Armstrong has ever sounded better, nor have their harmonies sounded better than in this little 10-15 minute clip from the BBC.
This is, and I think this is one of the best pure, straight up, adrenalized rock and roll recordings in history. I think this is one for the short list. I think this is pretty tough to beat, this particular air shot. And I've listened to a lot of Green Day of late when I've been running stairs. Yesterday and today, I listened to those three albums. They had come out, Uno, Dos, and Trey, and I think it was 2012. And you can tell that, like, I mean, they're catchy, but they're not the same as they were. A lot of times, like, people have songs, and they have their best songs come out, and it's spent early, and maybe that was the best they were going to have. So, like, you look at the lyrics compared to those albums from 2012, they're a completely different level, even though they're much younger men. But this is, take any of these songs. I think they're better on this BBC version than they are even, it's not knocking like the Dookie version of When I Come Around, but feel how heavy and hard and guttural that riff hits in this radio version. And it is one of the best riffs ever written in popular music. It truly is. I don't think it gets enough credit because people just thought they were kind of like this post Buzzcocks blend of punk and melody music, and they weren't like really like true punk, and that was sort of the knock on Green Day at the time. And this session is, I assume the session will be out in full, and this album of their BBC songs that are coming out in December. But this is the only BBC session from 94, and I thought about it afterwards because it's in my head now that you remember, like, oh no, it's live rock and roll. I am against that. I only like da da da. So I was thinking, oh, surely Kimball, he'll be able to. You ready for it, Kimball? He'll be able to come around on this.
Yeah. Well, I'm no basket case, believe me.
Oh, Kimball, I was going to like make a joke about Long, but we need to keep this a family.
Well, no, what's interesting to me, though, with these, we've talked about a few of these BBC sessions on the program here with you, and musicians seem to really rise to the occasion for these because they're all always high quality.
Despite the generation, and it's like you could remove like official rock and roll albums, like studio albums, and you could just be left with BBC recordings. And you could tell a pretty fantastic story of rock and roll. You could tell the Beatles story as well as possible. And you have sort of other acts too, like the Stones and the Who. They weren't quite as decorated on the BBC as the Beatles were, but we've talked about Joy Division, and we talked about Echo and the Bunnymen, Peel Sessions, and groups of that nature. And it's some of the best music for all of these groups. It's some of the best music they ever made. I mean, I think, to me, the most, we've said this before, the most Beatlesque of all recordings is the 1963 BBC recordings. And so Green Day, I don't know, there's something that got into bands. It was like playing Madison Square Garden. Or it's like, I've seen certain bands doing their first show in the United States. Like, there's this band that had an album in 2002, was their debut in the band. Well, rather foolishly called themselves The Music. And this was a dumb thing to do because like the internet was just sort of like taking off and you really needed a specific name. But they were an excellent band. And I saw their first show at this little club in Cambridge and there were like seven people there, but they were going for it. So the Vaccines' first show. So I think you have these rise to the occasion gigs where they just mean something to you personally, like your first NHL game. And so the BBC clearly, for both English bands and an American band like Green Day, it meant a lot to them. It was like that first night out in the Garden Ice.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Visit the website, of course, colinfleminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog. Get your hands on Colin's book on Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club 1963. Keep your eyes open for the soon-to-be-released Scrooge book as well. And next week, Colin, I'm out. Bruce will be filling in, so you know, prepare to blow his mind in whatever way you deem necessary.
Oh, I'll have to come up with something. I have to be on my A game for that.
I have no doubt you'll both thrive. I look forward to listening, and we'll check in with you again very soon.
All right, sounds good, my friend.
Colin Fleming, every week on Downtown.